Megan, Anna, and I are so excited to have a repeat sponsor who's supporting the Divergent Conversations podcast. The Landmark College Success Center, located in San Mateo, California, provides academic support, executive functioning coaching, and transition to college skills training for neurodivergent learners, both in person and online. A subsidiary of Landmark College, landmark.edu, the world's first and foremost college for neurodivergent students, the Success Center is equipped to put you or your student on your path to success. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. That's landmark.edu/successcenter. Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Divergent Conversation and our series where we're talking through some of the process of coming to know and then the emotional experiences that come up for a lot of us. Last week, we talked about diagnosis and assessment, some considerations there. And another question that we've been getting a lot, Patrick, is around all of this conversation around, well, is autism an epidemic? And what the hell is happening here? So What do you think? Is autism an epidemic?
I would go with an emphatic no. And, you know, I think back when a lot of directory conversation was happening in this country, we talked briefly on that. I know you kind of did a really extensive, deep conversation with Dr. Donna Henderson, one of the authors of Is This Autism? And really broke this down in a way that both of your incredible minds could. And we're going to link that to this episode. And no, it's not an epidemic. I mean, you made this one post that was like, this is why we don't have an autism epidemic. Here's all the research, all the information. The DSM's expanded. We have self-identification. Now, people who are getting missed are no longer getting missed as often. Not ever, but as often. Of course, there's not an epidemic. And also, let's just like define the epidemic. I can't say the word. What's the word when you are like the definition of a word or the origin is
epidemiological.
Oh my God.
I want to say epistology. Wait, I can't say. There's a branch of philosophy which is about knowledge, how we come to know things. Epidemiology.
That word. Yes. Thank you.
Is that it?
Yes. And if we define epidemic. And I'm just going to read it out loud. A widespread occurrence of an infectious disease in a community at a particular time. So when we're using language like this, it's for a reason. Mm-hmm. And originated in the 17th century from the French, epidemique. But nevertheless, a prevalence of disease amongst the people. So one, I just think that we have to understand that words matter and language really matters. And the words that we use really play a role here.
That's so interesting. I think I've been so busy like busting the myths that I haven't even paused to think about how horrific of a word that is and how it's and what that conveys. Like this is an epidemic. This is a, like you use the word infectious in there of, yeah, which automatically then brings shame to any of us who, well, I'm autistic and yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm not going to get too political on this podcast. I think that certain words are used for certain reasons and to create certain reactions. So when we are seeing words being thrown around in this country and in other countries too, it's not just this country. Epidemic is a word that epidemic, disease, disorder, things like that are, we're saying this should be cured. This should be fixed. This should almost be eradicated from society.
Well, it brings a fight flight and it gets back to, we have kind of nodded to this in previous episodes that under the current administration, there is a lot of if we can find the bad object and say, this is why your life is hard right now. This is why groceries are hard right now. If we can create a bad object to point to, there's that's a lot of the strategy being used around, let's use rhetoric that creates us versus them, that creates the sense that we are being attacked by this outside force. And if we address that thing, we will all be good again, or great again, I should say. I feel like we are being cautious in how we use words because of safety, not because we, like when you said, I don't want to get political, I feel like there's a few ways to interpret that. You and I are both people that come and go from the country a lot. And so we are being cautious for safety. Not because we're not political.
Correct. Just trying to let people read between lines with context. But then I do realize we have a lot of people that sometimes can struggle with context, myself included. So yes, just trying to protect ourselves. The answer is obviously, the answer is no, there's not an autism epidemic. Autistic people have always been here. I mean, we have drawings and like cave drawings from thousands of years ago that would suggest that autistic people existed all throughout life and generationally. We just didn't know what to call it. But autistic people have always been here, going to continue to be here. It does play a role in the conversation that we had last week about diagnosis, discovery, self-identification. It definitely creates more shame and stigma. And I also see a lot of people like boldly proclaiming like, this is who I am. And I think there's no right or wrong answer, because at the end of the day, it is about safety and protection, and you all have to make your own individual decisions about what feels most comfortable for you.
Yeah. So autism is also more visible right now as part of what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not to say that it doesn't mean that there's not the possibility that true prevalence rates are rising. Like that's definitely possible, especially my very like cheeky response when I was listing out the reasons. I can't remember if I actually put this on social media. I definitely wanted to, was like, reason number four, autistic people have sex. Like we are meeting each other more now because we're meeting through digital space. We procreate. And beyond that, and this is something that Donna mentions in the conversation, which we'll transition to, but is that the prevalence rate of everything is rising. And so like you can look at all mental health conditions and all like neurodevelopmental conditions, like the prevalence rates of everything is rising. So we're not saying that it's impossible that true prevalence rates are rising. But when you look at those graphs that show that huge spike, that is not what that is capturing. That is capturing all the social context pieces, all the ways that we're screening more, all of the huge, huge changes that have happened to the DSM and the diagnostic criteria.
And this will be a future episode in the series of Everyone's a Little Bit Autistic. So we talk about that to some degree in future episodes as well. And I think that when you see it in such, let's also say that the umbrella under like the spectrum of neurodivergence and neurodiversity, there's so many neurodivergent experiences, but autism and ADHD get talked about probably in the media. I don't know the numbers, but significantly more than most. So I think that's another component, right? Is like you said, it's in social media all the time. It's in mainstream media all the time. It's talked about a lot. And it wasn't talked about a lot a decade ago. I mean, 6-7 years ago. When was I in grad school? 2012 to 2015. Jesus. I think we used the words autism and ADHD like twice in a childhood development course. That was about it.
Yeah. I mean, we're really in the middle of this kind of awareness, like, boom, of there's so much more awareness than there was, even 5 years ago.
I mean, with any marginalized group, I think there can become these zeitgeists and these, like, societal messaging, especially from certain rhetoric and propaganda. And this is not comparing the two, but there was a lot of similar conversation when there was a lot of gay people coming out of the closet and a lot of lesbian people coming out in the late like 70s and early 80s. It was like there's an epidemic of homosexuality, homosexual. Jesus Christ.
You sound like me today. Usually I'm the one struggling with the words.
Fried. And again, used to say like society is creating these people. And
yeah.
There's an issue with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're different than us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is, I think humans in general can, especially when we're in our defensive or reactionary states, fall into us versus them thinking. But I think, especially in the States, I don't know, there's just something about our culture, especially our culture right now. But I think our culture at its roots, that there's a lot of that us versus them and rhetoric. And so,
the only
that's been used toward marginalized groups again and again in our, our country.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that the only way colonization works
and
keeping certain people in power works is to create us.
We're literally founded off of like the most objectifying us versus them way of being. And it's continued to have a ripple impact in our culture. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that for those of you listening, wherever, whatever stage of this journey you're in, I know it can feel really scary sometimes when certain words are thrown around or statistics are thrown around, and it can make you question your own sense of self, or it can make you feel like less than, or there can be more shame, there can be more stigma, there can be more discrimination. So we just
hope people asking questions that are hard to answer. Like, I bet a lot of autistic people who are out have gotten a lot of questions around this. And even people who might think it's small talk. Oh, I hear it's an epidemic. And so then you're in a position of like needing to educate more, which can be laborious. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we do hope that this conversation that we will...
we'll transition into. So we'll transition into this next. So to give listeners context, this is a conversation that I recorded with Dr. Donna Henderson in April, when this was shortly after RFK came out with the comments that he did. And we decided, let's just hop on a call and record a conversation about what's happening. We have no idea what we're going to do with it, but let's just do this. I did release it back in April on my Substack. It will be linked here in our YouTube, but if you would also like to watch the video, my team went back through after our conversation and made slides to go with it, because we're talking about a lot of dates and numbers, and we thought the visual prompts would be really helpful. So if you're someone who does well with visual prompts, then you can either check that out. That video has remained free and open to access, but you can also, if you go to our YouTube, you can also see the video version that will have the slides and visual prompts. It is a longer conversation. But I think we walk through a lot of really, really good historical context that helps explain why we are where we are.
Yep. And I hope that helps just affirm and debunk some of these myths and misconceptions. And I hope it also helps validate your own experiences if you do identify as a part of our community. I appreciate you and Dr. Donna Henderson doing that work and putting that mental energy and labor into this as well, because I enjoyed having her on here when we did the Neurotype series. I only met her very briefly, but have a profound respect for her and what she has contributed to both the ADHD and autistic community. So I hope you all enjoy it. I hope you all enjoy this series as we embark upon this journey together over like 16 episodes. I don't know what else to say.
We'll see you next time.
We will see you next Friday on all major platforms and YouTube. Like, download, subscribe, share. See ya.
Well, good morning, Donna. Good afternoon to you.
Good morning to you. It is afternoon here.
So I'm just going to set the stage for whoever ends up listening to this. Last week, Okay, my brain. RK Kennedy? Yeah.
RFK.
RFK. Last week, RFK did the whole thing, autism epidemic. You and I chatted, and I was kind of like, I feel like it'd be really fun to have a conversation with you. We record it, and then we'll, I don't know, put it out to the world somehow. But right now, as we're recording this, we don't really know what we're going to talk about, and we don't really know where we're going to release this. We're both in our ADHD energy of like, this feels like an important thing to talk about. And it's something you and I have both thought a lot about. And yeah, so do I have that context right of like what we're doing here?
Yes. And if anybody has ever doubted that either of us is an ADHDer, this will surely do the trick. We have absolutely no plan here.
Yes. This is, this is us in our ADHD kind of magic. And we'll see if something cool comes out of it or if it's like a rambly mess. And we're like, well, that was cool to see you today, Donna. Bye.
Yeah. At least we get to see each other and hang out for a little while.
Yeah. Well, honestly, there's been so many times that we've met to work on projects. And I've been like, oh my gosh, I wish we were recording this because I just often when I meet with you, I really love the generative ideas that come from these conversations.
Yeah, I always, always learn from you. We always inevitably have a moment of, oh my God, that's how you see it. This is how I see it. And it's always fun.
Yeah, I do love that. Yes, because we can kind of zoom out and reflect on the cross neurotype pieces as they come up. So I guess, yeah, maybe I'll zoom out to, I'm sure you've had this question before. Like I actually had like graphics like drafted in my Canva to talk about the autism epidemic thing like for months that I've just not posted. Because this is not a new question. Like we've gotten this question for years. There's always been people who are like, it's an autism epidemic. So I'm sure this is something you've thought about before last week, before RFK, whatever initials he is that I always forget. So what comes up for you? Because I'm sure you've gotten this question hundreds of times.
Honestly, every time I get this question, what comes up for me is individuals that I know, and you are a perfect example of that. It's people like you who 20 years ago, you would never have been recognized as autistic. 30 years ago, I mean, you would have been laughed at if you even brought it up. You wouldn't.
I still would be.
You still would be, right? Yeah. I mean, 10 years ago, it would have, I think, been almost impossible for you to get a diagnosis. It's really in the past 5 to 10 years that we're making such good progress, right? I think you're such a great example of this.
Yeah, I talk about that. So I just recorded and released the Lost Generation course, which is, I feel like it's my like synthesis of my last 4 years of learning, and your influence is all over that course. So thank you. But I talk about that of like, I'm part of this generation and that I would not have received a diagnosis in the 80s or 90s. People, first of all, because of the diagnostic criteria being used, but also people just weren't looking at shy academic girls, especially girls who also are ADHD. So then there's the like complexity of traits showing up and thinking autism. There was a study, I think you were the first one that pointed me to it, that talked about how, I think it was done across 4 countries. This is how my brain works. I can remember the details of the study, but not the author. It was done across 4 studies, but it showed people born after the mid-1990s were 4 times more likely to receive a diagnosis after the age of 18 versus those born previous. And so that's something I like to tell clinicians of. So if you're working with anyone born before mid-1990s, like this should be on your radar.
And as I think when John Elder Robison read that article, he wrote some piece about it. And he also pointed out that the data showed that the older you are, the less likely you are to be recognized as autistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've heard you talk about this too. So the older you are, less likely, because like just what was the diagnostic criteria that was being used in childhood, what we knew about autism. But then also, then they're working with adult providers. And one thing that we know is adult providers, they're not trained in adult autism. And there's that assumption, well, if it's autism, it would have been caught in childhood. So there's like that double impact happening.
Exactly. Adult providers get almost no training in autism. Hopefully that's changing. But historically, And they have no, so they have no knowledge, they have no confidence. And like you're saying, there is that underlying assumption. Even if it crosses their mind, the next thought is usually, oh, somebody would have caught it by now. And so then they don't consider it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I heard you talk about this in your autism training you did. The other thing will be providers, maybe autism's actually been ruled out before, but again, someone who had, maybe it was based on an older version of the DSM being used, or is a provider not aware of masking, and that will carry a lot of weight of like, oh, well, it's been looked into, it's been ruled out, so nope.
Right. And they're not willing to open it up again or even look back and think, well, why was it ruled out? And quite often it was ruled out because she made eye contact, because she has a sense of humor, right?
Oh my gosh. I've heard that so many times. And I feel embarrassed. Do you feel embarrassed, like, for our field when you hear stories?
Embarrassed and very apologetic. I want to go around apologizing to people. Yeah, yeah. I actually worked very closely with the grad student, and the name of her dissertation was, "But She Made Eye Contact," because it was all about this. It was a great title.
That is such a good title. Did that get published?
Not yet. Hopefully it will be.
Yeah. But she made eye contact.
Right? Because we've heard that phrase over and over and over and over and over again. Yeah.
That is such a good title. Yeah. Yeah, but people will pick one thing. And again, this is something I heard you say in a training. People will assume, because if you can do one thing that's like not a stereotypical autistic trait, clinicians will rule it out. Like
they code a behavior as a non-autistic behavior. Like making eye contact is a non-autistic behavior in some people's eyes. So if you do that once, it negates all the million autistic traits and behaviors that they're also noting, right?
Which is such bad science. Like, for being a science field, can you imagine that with almost any other diagnosis?
No, I can't. I mean, it's beyond science. It defies common sense.
Which goes back to the stereotypes. And that's something I talk about a lot, is the stereotypes that have really created this cultural archetype have made it so hard, like that gets into our brains at a very fundamental level. So even if we have clinical training on top of that, it doesn't undo that. And so for parents, like I know that made it hard for me to see my female child, because I had the archetypes. And looking back, there were obvious signs. Like, we literally had her hearing checked when she was 3 because she stopped responding to her name.
Yeah.
No one thought autism.
Yep. Like, and especially we know this, if somebody is physically attractive and intelligent and compliant, like all of those serve to cover up the autism in clinicians' eyes, right? And not just clinicians, parents, teachers, everybody, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. This brings to mind a whole nother reason and for all of this that we're talking about, which is diagnostic overshadowing, because so many of these kids and adults get other diagnoses that clinicians are more comfortable with, like ADHD or anxiety or borderline or whatever, right?
We'd like to take a moment to talk about Jane, one of our sponsors who helped make this episode possible. Jane is a practice management software built for every kind of mental health practitioner and is thoughtfully designed with your clients in mind. Jane makes it convenient to meet with individuals, couples, or families, whether that's online, via Jane's telehealth options, or in person.
From day one, you can expect unlimited customer support through onboarding that sets you up for success and a 99.99% software reliability that ensures that Jane is always ready to start the day with you.
Just as you are always learning and improving, Jane is too. The team at Jane values customer feedback and uses it to design even more helpful features. So you can think of Jane as a software that grows with you.
If you're curious to see Jane in action, head to jane.app/mentalhealth/US to book a free one-on-one demo. You can also mention the code DCPOD at signup for a 2-month free grace period on your new Jane account.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And this is something I think you and I could both nerd out on literally all day. I actually made for the course, I made a new graphic. I'd love to show it to you where I made autism in the middle, and then I put like OCD, PTSD, and I started actually mapping out like this criteria of PTSD could be like, this is a way it could overshadow this autistic trait.
Wow.
Because it, and especially because we know, you know, Johan Nyrenius' studies that he's doing around autistic adults in psychiatric clinics is so eye-opening. And one of his most recent ones was showing how we have more co-occurring mental health conditions on average than non-autistic people. So it's not like, oh, the social anxiety is overshadowing the autism. It's like the social anxiety and the PTSD, and that like there's often like three or four mental health conditions in the mix. And yeah, especially because autism is just not on people's minds or rule out lists. It won't look like autism. It'll look like a really messy clinical picture of social anxiety, PTSD, depression, bipolar.
Right, right. And until recently, clinicians weren't aware of this whole dynamic. And now I think more and more clinicians are becoming aware of the need to step back and look at the whole person. And I think that's contributing to the increase in diagnosis rates and recognition rates.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't talking about that 10 years ago. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting because when we talk about the increasing rates, like my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is it's all based on, I think it's usually 8-year-olds they look at.
So it's not even tapping into
the adults that are getting diagnosed, which we know there are many, but it's 8-year-olds. So now it's just been updated to 1 in 31 8-year-olds have an autism diagnosis, which means we're getting a lot better at screening children, which is great from a like being able to provide supports and education supports and self-understanding for kids. It would be interesting to even look at prevalence rates in adults, because we know that it's just, there's so many undiagnosed adults.
Right. Yeah. And when I started doing this work, I started getting a lot of clinicians who see kids and adolescents reaching out to me for case consultation. And now it's more and more all about the adults, the case consultation work I'm doing. So many clinicians who see adults are saying, my practice is fundamentally changing as I think about this. And as people are coming in wondering if they're autistic, or I'm wondering if they're autistic, I've seen a huge shift there.
How do you feel about that? Like just in the sense of the work you do? And because, yeah, you started out as like a pediatric neuropsychologist.
Actually, I started out with adults.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Okay. In a previous lifetime, I was actually the director of a brain injury program, an acquired brain injury program for adults. Then I went into private practice just doing ADHD, LD work, and only with adults. And then I gradually kept moving my age range younger and younger. It went from 18 to 17 to 16. Now, I've been at 6 for many, many years. I'm not going to go below 6. And I had to do a lot of retraining and get supervision and everything for that. But
And now it's going back up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I both love that phrase, the lost generation of autistic adults, which I think was originally Meng Shuang Lai and Simon Baron Cohen.
I'm so glad that you can pronounce both their names, because I am typically like, just go read this article. Which I learned this word from you, phonetical dyslexia. So pronunciation is really hard. So I'm really glad that you can pronounce both of their names, because yes, they are the ones that coined it. That's my understanding as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I got you on the pronunciation. I got you. No worries.
I will just like, whenever there's a hard word, I'll be like, Donna. You. And Simon, again, can't pronounce his last name, but it's interesting that he coined it, because he's a controversial figure in the autism space. But then that phrase feels so affirming. So I'm kind of glad he's second author on that article.
Yeah. Yeah, and Meng Shuang Lai, who's the first author, is truly one of my all-time favorite autism researchers. He's truly amazing.
One thing we know is research happens, and this is true of medical and clinical, And it takes a long time, like sometimes 20 years to trickle down to clinical work, which is also why I got so excited about your book, because it's one of the things that you are help bridging the gap between the research and the clinical training. Now to get training programs to actually start using that book and to start doing the training. But that is also part of this increase, is that things that are known in the autistic community or even in research take time to get into clinical training.
For sure. For sure. But I mean, we started this conversation with me saying that you are such a great example of why the prevalence rates are going up. And as I think about it, I'm a great example of why the prevalence rates are growing up in a totally different way, which is that 20 years ago, so I was licensed in 1991. When I went to graduate school, I don't know that the word autism was uttered once. I mean, if it was, I certainly didn't notice it. I absolutely never had a class or an entire lesson on it. It just wasn't part of my training in the late 1980s. And so I never diagnosed autism year after year after year after year. I didn't diagnose it. Now I diagnose it all the time. And there are tons of clinicians like me who got training in this so much later, so recently, and now we're diagnosing it a lot. That's not an increase in prevalence. That's an increase in clinician awareness, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a good example, just like you are.
That'd be a really interesting list. Again, I think in visuals, like crossing out increase in prevalence, strikeout, and then an increase of, and like, what actually is this an increase of? So one would be, what did you just say? Clinical awareness. What else?
Can I put with that clinical, I'm writing these down too.
Yeah.
Clinical confidence.
I love that. Yes. Clinical confidence.
Mm-hmm. Because when I first started diagnosing autism and a lot of people around me weren't seeing it the way I was, and there were times that I didn't diagnose it that I wanted to because I wasn't confident enough. If I was getting pushback from the psychiatrist, say, or from the parents, I wasn't confident enough to really go to bat for that kid and help everybody understand.
Well, especially a while ago, it was seen as giving someone tragic news. And so you do want to make sure it's not anything else before I hand over this tragic news to this family or this child. I guess it's maybe an increase in autism appreciation or neurodiversity appreciation, where more and more people and families and clinicians aren't seeing this as like a tragic thing. Now that's still actually quite prevalent, but much less so than, 20 years ago.
100%, I agree. Can we call that clinician comfort?
Clinician comfort. Yes. So I feel like we need like a clinical version of this, but then also like a societal.
So we have clinician ones, clinician awareness, and knowledge, right? Which are two different things, right? Awareness is just generally having autism on your radar, which in and of itself is a big deal. And then separately, clinician knowledge, actually knowing how to understand the diagnostic criteria, knowing what questions to ask and how to listen to people. And then clinician confidence to not be afraid and to trust our clinical knowledge. And then clinician comfort to not think we're giving horrible news to somebody. Like, you have cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Wow, that was really brilliant what your mind just did there. Clinical awareness, clinical knowledge, clinical confidence, clinical comfort.
I don't know. I was just thinking, I don't know how this fits into it, probably in comfort and confidence, but I can't tell you how many clinicians have said to me, I have some clients I am sure are autistic, but I don't feel empowered to bring it up, much less diagnose it, because either A, I'm master's level, like an LCSW, but in many, if not most states, they are allowed to diagnose autism, but they've been given to believe that it has to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, which is not true. And that's so important because it's an access issue. Or B, they're not trained to give the ADOS, which makes me absolutely crazy, mm-hmm. because you don't need to give an ADOS to diagnose autism. So these, misunderstandings that clinicians have about all of this.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a huge piece of it too, is there is so much fear. Like that was, it's interesting hearing you talk about your training experience, because mine is not that long ago. I graduated in 2021, and autism was talked about. I briefly remember it in our like psychopathology class when going through the DSM, and then in the developmental class, but adult autism was not talked about like in-depth training. It was just very clear, if you do autism, then you do like another 5 extra years and it's like your residency and it's you go specialize in it. Otherwise, it was not talked about, which is wild. Again, when we like Johan Nyrenius's work, which showed 1 in 5 people seeking outpatient psychiatric care were, or 18.9% to be more specific, were autistic, and only 0.53% knew. So it's wild that in mental health, when we're training to be mental health providers, we are not talking about adult autism. That was a rabbit trail. Training. My training also did not talk about autism. And I also, even as a psychologist, I was like, I don't think I can diagnose this. One of the most empowering conversations I had, it was my internship year. And I wanted to diagnose autism. And I wasn't sure I could. And my supervisor was like, well, it's in the DSM. Like, you can diagnose it. And that, and this was a non-autistic supervisor. And it was really beautiful to me that she, like, kind of granted me permission to rethink this idea that, you know, autism can't be diagnosed without robust neuropsych assessments or the ADOS.
Yeah, I'm like making a list. We both like making lists, I think. It was the list that I was writing while you were talking, because that was really, really wonderful, Megan Anna. Myths that clinicians believe. There are so many myths that clinicians believe, that they need to be doctoral level. That's not necessarily true. That they need to be a neuropsychologist or to do some kind of testing or even rating scales. That's not true. That they need to be ADOS trained. That's not true. That they need specialized training in autism. That's kind of sort of partially true, right? Like, we need to be educated. We need to understand these things, but like, you don't necessarily need like a specialized postdoc.
Like, go take your training on autism, or read your book, or take my last generation training. And like, I feel like people would be good to go.
Yeah.
With that info.
Yeah. And do case consultation when you need it. If you have a case you're not sure about, right? It doesn't have to be doing some years long specialized training at Harvard Medical School or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I think there was one more myth. Oh, if it was, you said this earlier, this myth that if somebody else ruled it out, then I either don't need to consider it or shouldn't consider it or can't consider it. Or am excused from considering it.
Oh, I love that. Excused from considering it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And partly that excuse, I mean, it's complex to consider, especially if you've not been trained in it. So I can see. Yeah. Excused from considering it. And if there's emotional discomfort, because if you do have that ableism around it of like, well, I would definitely not feel comfortable bringing this up to a client. So like, yeah, we don't need to consider that bad thing. There'd be relief in that for a lot of clinicians.
Right.
Did I ever tell you about the time in my training? It was my assessment class the very first year. And so obviously when we're learning to do assessments, we first do them on ourselves. And it was the kind where it gives you like a printout report of things to look into. And on that report, the second condition listed was autism. I like see the visual, autism spectrum disorder. And I remember looking at that and being like, what? Like, what the heck? Like, first of all, I had my own ableism. I had a negative response to seeing that. And then I like laughed at it. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Why would, and I had all those thoughts of like, that's a childhood thing. There's no way that like, what is this test that's recommending I look into autism? And I just totally disregarded it for, you know, 5 more years until I revisited the autism conversation.
That is amazing, because it just goes to show you like how far we've come, right? That you didn't even, you took that test in a time not that long ago. We're not going to do the math.
Okay. 2017 is when I took that and saw that.
2017, that is not that, less than 10 years ago, that your response was, this is obviously a mistake. How absurd, right? Mm-hmm. Unbelievable, right? Yeah. How far we've come. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I literally was staring at data that was like, you should look into this. And I was just like, nope.
Right. And if you had brought it to any clinician at that time, they would have said, you're right. This is a mistake. You must have answered the questions wrong or something. So let's see. We made a list of clinician reasons for the increased recognition. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say, let's make more lists.
Yeah. Well, perfect. That's what I was going to say. It's like, I kind of love this social historical context. And I actually like talking about this because there is a lot, understandably, there's a lot of anger toward clinicians, which again, like very understandable. But one of my big things is I like to kind of melt defenses and shame when I'm introducing new ideas, just because I think it's more humanizing, more effective. So I like to walk people through, like, here's the last kind of 100 years of autism. So if you feel like, oh my goodness, oh no, I've been missing people, like it's okay in the sense of we are all working with a very specific social context that has led to this moment. And I think that kind of zoom out view is really helpful. Like if we think to just, 60, okay, now my math is being stretched, 80 years ago, 70 years ago, we were talking about this as child onset schizophrenia.
Yep.
Like so much has changed.
Right. Yeah. I actually, at one point went through the DSM, the various DSM, the way they wrote up autism, and it was sort of mind-blowing. And early on in, I want to say it was the second DSM, I have notes here somewhere, autism wasn't even mentioned as its own.
It's the
thing.
Third DSM.
It was right. So yeah. I'm just saying, like in the 1970s, it was part of schizophrenia. It was like a childhood kind of psychosis, right? So if you raised children in the 70s, there was zero chance you were even going to remotely think of autism for your kid, right? And then you're right, it was the DSM-3, right? Mm-hmm. But even then, that was 1980, that was infantile autism. So the name tells you they were really thinking about children under the age of 3. And the diagnostic criteria were very extreme in the way they were written. And I think there were like 8 and you had to meet all 8. There was no flexibility. And the criteria, I just pulled some of them up. Onset before 30 months of age. So very strict there. Pervasive lack of responsiveness to other people. Gross deficits in language development. I mean, I could go on and on, but you get the idea. I mean, it was really extreme.
What we now would say is a very specific presentation of autism.
Right. And only that, for sure. And so if you were, we're going through this, you brought this up because of like the parents and clinicians who might feel guilty about not having recognized kids from the past. But so if you were raising or clinically seeing kids in the 1980s, those were the diagnostic criteria. Of course you were going to miss them, right?
Yeah. And it's why I can't say like, oh, I was missed in childhood. I wasn't. Like, I wouldn't have met that criteria.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So like as Bill Gates said, I think he said recently, if I was being raised now, I don't think he said I was missed in childhood, right?
Yeah. No, his language, I noticed his language too, because it wasn't even like, I'm autistic. It was, it was very distancing, but I actually enjoyed pieces of that interview, but it's just interesting his language. If I was a child now, I would be diagnosed with this.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then 1987 was the revision of the DSM-3. So the 3R, and they did relax things a little bit. Mm-hmm. So then you needed like 8 out of 16 criteria. But the wording and the examples were still completely extreme. So here's some examples. Treats other people as if they were pieces of furniture.
Wait,
read, That was an example in it. Reads phone book to uninterested ear. Market distress, for example, if a vase is moved from its usual position. I got to get you one more. Insists on carrying around a piece of string.
Those are so specific, and it's not getting at like what's happening beneath. Like, why is that string important? Why might a child be rehearsing text to someone else? Those are so, and those are so Rain Man.
So Rain Man, right? And Rain Man. And so that was 1987, and Rain Man came out in 1988. I don't know if there's a connection there, but interesting. Oh. And in that one, it still was very much focused on before 36 years of age. Although they did say, like, as a clinician, you could say, oh, this is a late diagnosis, meaning after 36 months of age would be like a late diagnosis.
That's wild. Yeah, that means that has very different meaning now when we talk about late diagnosis.
Right.
Am I like
you're 60s. Right. Exactly. Do you think this is helpful?
This is so helpful. I think this walkthrough is great. And maybe we can even make some visuals to go with it. Okay. So we're up to 87.
Okay. So 87, still really restricted childhood. So then in 1994, we had the DSM-4, and it was called Autistic Disorder, and which was separate from Asperger's and Rett's syndrome and pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, which people may or may not know the old joke about PDD-NOS. So pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. It was like a wastebasket, I think this kiddo is kind of sort of autistic, but I'm not sure and I'm not confident. So I'm going to go with PDD-NOS. And we used to all say it stood for physician didn't decide or psychologist didn't decide. That's what the PDD was. It was like a way where you didn't have to really decide or
you didn't have to commit to the big bad thing.
Right. Exactly. You didn't have to drop the A word. Yeah. And so that what was in there as of 94. But it still said onset prior to 3 years. Even in the 90s, we had that onset prior to 3 years. And there was no talk about camouflaging at that point still. Mm-hmm. So that was the DM.
And then DSM-4. Asperger's was also introduced.
Exactly. Yeah. Asperger's was in there. And I had a question as I was thinking about this. When the CDC talks about rates of autism diagnosis, when they were looking at the DSM-4, like in 94, 95, 96, all those years, did they include people who were then diagnosed with Asperger's or Rett's or PDD?
I don't know.
If not, that's a big deal.
And that would be a huge, like from a data perspective, that would be a huge spike because all of a sudden, if those were spread out across five different diagnoses and then all of a sudden they become one, that in and of itself would be a huge spike in the data. Wait, that's a good question. I want us to put this out and then I want someone who understands.
Someone to tell us.
To tell us.
Because I also read that over 90% of the kids who had been diagnosed with any PDD, so autism, Asperger's, PDD-NOS, Rett's, I feel like I'm forgetting one, but you get the idea. Over 90% of them met the DSM criteria when we went to the DSM-5. Mm-hmm. So they are all autistic.
Yeah.
So we need to understand that.
That's
data point.
That is one I had not considered. Like I've considered several points for the increase, but I had not considered that data reporting. That's huge.
Yeah, huge.
And wait, when would that would have gone into effect in 2013?
In 2013.
So that, because the graph I have and the one that's often cited is from 2000 to 2020, where we go from 100, 1 in 150 to 1 in 36, now 1 in 31, because it's a huge, but that would have made such a big difference in 2013 if all of a sudden okay, we need to know that.
It goes up sharply after that. It really, and it's a combination of all the different kinds of things we're talking about today, but that's a big piece of it.
And ADHD, like you can now diagnose both ADHD and autism when we get to, or are we done with DSM-4 before we jump
to... but this is good. Now let's make a list of all the changes in DSM-5. So like the first one is lumping all the things together.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll work on that list. All the
DSM-4. You do that. Okay. I'm done typing.
I'll list.
Okay. All right. DSM-5 changes. So one was all these different diagnoses got lumped together as autism spectrum disorder. So, and over 90% of the kids with all the other ones fit into this. So that's huge right there. Then, as you just pointed out, before 2013, clinicians were not allowed to diagnose autism and ADHD in the same person, which never made any sense to me. I have yet to meet somebody who understands that rule. And so think about it. If you're a clinician and you have to choose between diagnosing autism and diagnosing ADHD, right? What are you going to do? The big scary one or the one that everybody's comfortable with where you could just take a pill to fix it, right? So we know that that happened a lot. And now as of 2013 in the DSM-5, we could diagnose them together. The other big change in the DSM-5 was recognition of camouflaging. Like it actually says it in there. It says, you know, I forgot the wording.
And was that in the TR update or was the original DSM?
I think it was in the original DSM-5, not the TR update. Yeah. It said something like, symptoms may not manifest until social demands exceed limited abilities. Something like that.
It's very vague, but it's in there. Which is huge. Yeah.
And I'm pulling out my DSM now to check myself. I don't think there's anything about age for the first time. So they finally got rid of that. That's a clinician myth. Do you still have a clinician myth list going? This whole idea that it has to be shown by age 3 or any other age. Like there is no age. It says, okay, I pulled out my DSM. It has to be present in the early developmental period, but may not become fully manifest until social demands exceed limited capacities or may be masked by learned strategies in later life. And that's huge right there.
That is so huge. That is so huge.
Yeah.
So I thought, and I could be wrong, but I thought those were TR updates that were just put in 2020. But I
could be wrong too. So we need to find out.
Okay, we should find that out because that would signify a more like recent shift.
but I'm looking, so my little book here is copyright 2013. It's not the TR. This is my mini DSM.
Got it. You're right. Yeah. I know the TR did something because I remember being very like interested in what they were going to do. And I know they did something.
And it was minor.
It was really minor. For listeners, so like the DSM changes numbers every whatever, but then TR are kind of like updates between, like we're not ready to go to DSM-6, but we might update it. So there was like, you were earlier talking about, was it DSM-3 TR, which was kind of in between DSM-3 and 4. Okay, so that is DSM-5. I didn't realize that. That's actually good for me to know. And the TR updates were super minor.
The TR, it was nothing substantial. I remember writing the book. Right. Yeah.
We were all hoping for like really big updates in the TR. And then I remember I was like,
Yeah. It was really minor things. Yeah.
Okay. So DSM changes. So far I have all diagnoses get lumped into autism spectrum disorder. We get rid of Asperger's and all the other ones. Yeah. 90% fit into that. ADHD, you can now diagnose both. Masking and camouflaging is mentioned, and the age requirement is loosened.
And I'm not 100% sure about this. Maybe you'll remember. I think that's the first time sensory got put in there.
Yes.
Which is huge. That's huge.
Yes. Sensory got added. I want to actually look at the criteria. Was B, beyond adding sensory, was B, because now it's you have to meet 2 of the 4 for criteria B. Right. Are there other changes there that you're aware of beyond adding sensory?
I don't think so, because interests, repetitive behaviors, and flexibility, I think, have been in there for a long time. Yeah. I think sensory was the big change there, and making it 2 out of 4, which is like, I feel like I keep saying the word huge, but it was huge.
I mean, when you go from like, you have to meet all 8 of these criteria in DSM-3 that are very like specific to, yeah, here's 3 criteria A and 2, 4. And then there's examples of like all the ways this can show up. Yeah, I mean, that it is huge. It's a huge shift. Of course we'd go from 1 in 25,000 to 1 in, I mean, not of course, but to 1 in 31. But that makes sense. So yeah, this is a huge, huge one. And it's actually number one on my list of, I put together a list of 5 reasons, and my number one was broadening diagnostic criteria. So it is huge. It really is.
Right. And you know, it would be interesting, I don't know if anybody's done this, but take a group of autistic people and who absolutely meet the current criteria, and then see if they would have met criteria with the 2, with, yes, the 3, with the 4. I think that would be really telling.
And that actually would be a really wouldn't cool have. Video. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That'd be such a great way of visually capturing this. Yeah, right. I mean, there's so many of us. And it could even be like, well, no, one of them met criteria because they already had an ADHD diagnosis in 2010. So like,
right,
have for that right reason, and listing out the reasons why. Yeah. Okay, so diagnostic broadening.
Yeah, and then just our understanding of what each criteria means is the other way that we broaden our understanding of all of this, is that stimming doesn't necessarily just mean flapping or echolalia. Stimming can show up in countless ways, right? Like pacing, yeah, back and forth, or watching The Office 47 times.
Yeah. Or like for, yeah, me, something I've done my whole life, like I'll listen to a song on repeat for like a week. And, yeah, and like, never thought of that as stimming or weird. Or it was weird to me that other people like listened to songs, like a playlist. Like why, yeah, would your brain want that?
Yeah. And if I had to listen to the same, even a great song, like over and over again for a week, I'd lose my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. If someone, so I actually had she's also a psychologist. She's ADHD. I was autistic. I didn't know I was autistic. We were driving to a conference together, and we're, I think it was kind of in a like getting to know each other. Like, what's some of your favorite music? And I put my playlist up, and like, we wouldn't even finish a song and she'd move to the next one. And I was like, what is happening? Then I was looking back and like, oh, that was ADHD and autism there.
Maybe we need to design our own little questionnaire, and this could be part of it. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, do you prefer to listen to the same song over and over again for a while? Or do you prefer to move from one song to the next?
Rapidly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So more deep understanding. And I'd kind of put that in the awareness bucket too, as more lived experience, more people start talking about the autistic experience of like, hey, I do this thing, and this is what stimming can look like. Yeah, because so much of it was the stereotypical like hand flapping. Like that's the one people love to use. Right. It's like hand flapping.
You don't flap your arms, you can't be autistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Yeah. And special interest would be another one of like the ones that culturally blend in or are socially acceptable. Awareness that, yeah, like an intense interest in psychology or social justice, like that can also, right, be a special interest. It doesn't have to be obscure. Like it doesn't have to be bizarre is the word that was often used.
Oh, this might have been a change in the new DSM-2 in the 2013 from overtly atypical interest to either atypical or intense.
Yes.
I wonder if that was, do you know that is true?
I don't know it off the top of my head, but it feels right. And I want to know now, but it feels
me
right.
Too. I'm going to look it up later and I'll let you know.
Even with that update, a lot of clinicians will still, if it's not quote unquote bizarre,
yeah,
they'll miss the ones that are like atypical in intensity, but not content. Which also, right, again, that's weird of like, who gets to decide what's bizarre and what's not?
I know. I had a whole debate about this with a colleague once, because I had an 8-year-old who I was sure was autistic, and I was going through the criteria, and He had an interest in opera, and I thought that was atypical for not an eight-year-old, an eighth grader, for an eighth grade boy. I never met an eighth grade boy who was into opera. And her argument was, lots of people are into opera. There's nothing atypical about that, which is true. But for me, like, the context is everything. The context is of this boy. He wasn't musical. He didn't play an instrument. His parents weren't into opera. He didn't go to a theater-oriented school. Like, there was nothing about his life that made you go like, oh yeah, opera, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. So like, for the context of that person's life is the interest.
Right.
Quote unquote, bizarre. I like that way of thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And I mean, I don't use the word bizarre.
Yeah, I'm using it quote. Yeah. I'm using a lot of air quotes around it because it's would be like the pathologized way of looking at it.
Got it. Makes sense.
Or atypical.
So should we talk about this whole other category of increased prevalence rates?
Yes.
Do you want to bring one up? Go ahead.
Well,
do you have one?
Next on my list is more screening, but I don't know. Did you have one in mind?
I did, but I can wait. Okay. Yeah, definitely more screening. What were you thinking about there?
Well, again, when I look at that chart, specifically 2000 to 2020, some things that come to mind is like I think it was published in 2007, but I think it kind of went into effect in 2006, where the American Pediatric Association recommended routine screening for children. Yeah. And then we see that's one of the points where we start seeing a big spike. So just implementing routine screening is huge. And then I'm not as like fluent on education policy, but my understanding also is that there were some changes in like kind of how children could access supports, where there was more incentive to get an autism diagnosis for families because of the supports that could be offered through that. And so just from an incentives perspective for families, there's also more education supports to access if you have that diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so I think about, the screening and then like education shifts that just made it much more likely that we'd be catching autistic children.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I was wondering about that too. I didn't remember the exact year when the American Academy of Pediatrics started that, but
I don't recite phone books, but dates of studies like stick.
Maybe you're not autistic, Megan.
Cute. Got to rethink my career.
Yeah, there you go. You know, it crossed my mind too as you were saying that. I wonder too about insurance companies and when, you know, all this nonsense about, you know, you need an autism diagnosis for us to pay for you to have ABA. And of course, everybody needs ABA. And I wonder if there was a little bit of impact there too that motivated people to get the diagnosis so that their kids could get ABA. And to be clear, I'm not saying it was.
Yes.
I'm not.
Yes.
Or ABA, right? Yeah.
But that would have been one of those systemic pieces, right? Again, there was just so many system pieces that shifted from especially 2000 to 2020. Yeah. Insurance, screening. Yeah. Anything else in the screening bucket that you'd add?
I think you've hit the big ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was on your list?
So a few other things. One is I found myself wondering if, and I think that it has, if everything's just been increasing like crazy, and could we make a chart that shows the autism increases and the ADHD level increases and the anxiety level increases and the depression level, and even things like dyslexia. I wonder, is autism increasing more than everything else?
Does that mean more autistic people are having sex than?
Well, that was a whole other thing we needed to talk about, right?
So,
right?
So,
no, they're separate to me.
Oh, they're separate. Okay. So everything's increasing. And when you say everything's increasing in your mind, are you saying true prevalence is increasing or diagnosed cases are increasing?
I think probably both.
Okay.
I mean, I know kids are more, and adults, everybody's more anxious.
That's
now.
True. Yeah.
I mean, there's so much more anxiety now. There's so much more depression now. There's so much more ADHD now, right? There was a whole article in the New York Times this weekend about like the explosion of ADHD. So part of me wondered, like, so is autism different from all of these other diagnoses or not really?
So would you, I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but same thing with ADHD. Like we could say there's been an underdiagnosis. And this actually, this is something I like about you, Donna, is it's tempting to look at that and be like, it's not an epidemic. It's better identification. That's typically what I say. But I typically will have a footnote of like, and we can't rule out that there is a right. true increase in true prevalence. And that's kind of, and I like that you can hold the nuance of that, of maybe there is true prevalence increasing of all the things.
Yeah, I think there may be. And this is where we can now bring sex into it, right? So autistic people in our current culture may have better luck finding each other, finding partners, and procreating, like, because of the rise of technology.
It's literally right? what I said in my article of, like, we, because we know the cross-neurotype study, like, we tend to connect better with each other. And now with dating apps and with digital, like, we can find each other in the mating process. The mating process. Right. Whereas before, if you were just like, well, I'm going to find someone, like, in what, my local community? Or I don't know how people found, I mean, I guess I found my person in college. But yeah, it's so, it would be so much easier, I imagine, for autistic people to connect and then to have sex and then to have babies.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, when I was young and dating before technology, you had to go out there in the world and spontaneously talk to people and connect quickly enough and well enough to then continue on and build a relationship, which is harder for autistic people than for non-autistic
people. That sounds terrible. That sounds terrible to me. Everything you just described, I was like, why would you do that?
Right? Yeah. And then separately, the rise of technology in general has given a lot of autistic people, like think Bill Gates, jobs, careers.
Oh my gosh.
And that lead to, and that sort of that full on success in life that is more likely to potentially lead you to becoming a parent and having a family. Right. So I think there's that piece of it too.
Yeah. I think about this all the time with like social disability model and like I run a pretty successful business and I have like 4 employees, 3 of whom are ADHD. And none of our jobs would exist without the internet as it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's a huge shift, but shift in like it can create some financial stability, which I don't know that that's actually correlated with having more kids necessarily, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I sure don't know. I certainly haven't seen any research on it. It just feels like there might be. I just remember at one point hearing that there was concern because there was so much autism being diagnosed in Silicon Valley that they thought like there was something in the water there. And we were all like, no, y'all are autistic and you're having babies and it's all okay.
No, totally. Well, and I know that there's some pushback on this language of broader autistic phenotype. But then again, especially if you've got 2 tech people who are on that broader autistic phenotype, they're going to have children who I think would probably be more classically autistic or stereotypically autistic. And so absolutely that's happening. I think Steve Silberman did such a good job outlining that in Neurotribes. I think it was in his book that the number one medical field of like having autistic kids was actually the medical field. And then it was maybe engineering and then tech, which is really interesting, too, to think through where are the broader autistic phenotype folks. I don't want to quote it quite that confidently, but it was interesting. He had some data in there about the fields of like the parents of autistic kids.
Oh, that is interesting. Megan, Anna, you and I could just make a living coming up with dissertation topics. That would be such an interesting dissertation because I'm also thinking lawyers and college professors, right?
Yeah. So yeah, we're having babies. That's a huge one. We're connecting because of the digital world. Speaking of digital, I think that's its own point of just the internet has changed everything in regards to lived experience. And then we've connected as an autistic culture and community. And now we see ourselves recognized in each other. And that's just lifted the bar of awareness because A, we're connecting. B, we've really created some autistic culture, which in return, like that's how we know things like, well, stimming can look like this or like that. And so that's been so huge from an awareness perspective. And then also busting some of those myths around autism is a big, bad, terrible thing. So the internet, and again, if we look at that 2000 to 2020, yep. What like iPhones was 2010. And I feel like we've been living in the digital age the last 20 years and then the social media age, and it's just changed everything.
Yeah. Well said, well summarized for sure. Yeah. Go ahead. No, I want to hear it.
Well, I just gonna say, I do have one more point that I want to make sure and get to, but.
Do it. I think we've solved it.
Better recognition of underrepresented groups. So, for example, the research that's looked into autistic women has been huge, but then also BIPOC and genderqueer and trans. I think, I don't know what the most recent CDC, but I feel like the one that was in 1 in 36 was one of the most encouraging for catching Black children. Like, it was like, can't remember the exact rates, but the gap had lessened quite a bit. I think we know still, especially in Latinx populations, this is still very under identified. But especially with BIPOC children, we're getting a lot better. Historically, often like conduct disorders or OD, oppositional defiant disorder. There's some great research. I'm going to synthesize it this Friday, but I think on average, it takes what, like 3 years longer than a white child to get a diagnosis. And that research is back in, I think it was like 2007, kind of early 2000s. There's a huge discrepancy there. And then of course, autistic girls, like especially girls that do not have a co-occurring intellectual disability, more numbers because my brain is fun in that way. I think I might've first learned this from you, but this was early 2000s or late 1990s, where autistic girls with co-occurring intellectual disabilities, the prevalence was 2 to 1, two autistic mm-hmm. boys to one. But then without a co-occurring intellectual disability, I think they were using 80 or above, it jumps to 9 to 1.
Yep.
Meaning like it would make no sense for prevalence to actually shift that much. It just means we didn't know how to catch those girls. And so that's been a huge shift in that we're getting better at identifying anyone who's not a white cis boy with very stereotypical traits.
Right, right. Yeah, again, really, really well summarized. I don't know that I have anything to add to it except, yep, that's all true. And then if somebody is in multiple minority mm-hmm. groups, so if you're a Black trans female, right, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. even harder to identify for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then I always, again, this is a footnote I like to add. There's still plenty of white cis men who also are undiagnosed, even with stereotypical traits, because again, of how much has changed diagnostically and awareness and screening.
Right, right. I mean, I saw a boy this week, white cis boy, who had been seen on and off throughout his life and never diagnosed with autism. And I thought it was going to be like a really challenging case to figure out. And I mean, within 5 minutes of meeting him, he exhibited really clear, unambiguous mm-hmm. autistic traits.
Yeah.
And going through it with his parents, it was clear that his clinicians weren't comfortable with autism in the past. His parents were uncomfortable with autism in the past. They overtly said to me, we see this now and we're comfortable and we want this diagnosis. It's useful to see him through this lens. We didn't feel that way 10 years ago. We would have absolutely pushed back against this 10 years ago. And they were saying, we think that's part of the reason clinicians didn't diagnose it. None of the adults in the room were comfortable.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just reiterating what I said before, but even for a white boy.
That's so beautiful. And it comes full circle of it. I this is where I really I'm so grateful for the autistic community of the awareness work. And by awareness work, I also mean the like movement toward bringing forth affirming narratives of autism that is impacting clinicians. It's impacting parents because they're more likely to say, yep, I'm willing to look at this. And it's that is a huge driving force in the increase is that there is now a culture and a community who's saying, this is an experience that many of us have, and it is okay. And this is a word we're allowed to say.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I think that's so beautifully said. I go back to this experience I had in graduate school in 1987, maybe, where I thought I had never met a gay person before. Obviously, I had, but nobody ever talked about it back then. And one of my professors said that he was gay. He came out to our class in a very casual, like it wasn't a big deal. He was like, by the way, here's the deal. And it was the first moment of realizing, oh, they're all around me. I had no idea. And it's the same thing with autism. And every time an autistic person comes out and says, oh, and by the way, I'm autistic, it raises everybody's awareness.
Yeah.
Not just that it's everywhere, but that there's a million different ways it can look, right?
It's literally like, that's literally why I came out, like I had no idea what was going to happen when I came out as autistic and like professionally impact it would have. But I was like, I just need to do this. I need people to know there's like autistic psychologists out here. And Devin Price talks about this really beautifully in his, in the first autistic unmasking book of, I can't remember the exact quote, but like visibility is advocacy. And partly for those of us for whom we can more safely be visible. So as a white human with a lot of like so much privilege, right?
Yeah.
It is so much safer for me to be visible. And so the ability for me to do that, it also like raises the safety for everyone. So those of us for whom we can more safely be visible, it is really powerful advocacy.
Well, I know I speak for countless people, thousands of people, that your work is so appreciated. Just you, not only your intellectual work, which is massive, Megan Anna, but your personal work, understanding yourself, understanding your own experience, and then sharing that with the world. You make a huge difference, and we all appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And now I'm going to hot potato pivot because that is very meaningful to take in. But it's also, I'm going to try to take that in. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Good. I feel like we're at a stopping point.
Yeah, I think we are. And we've also talked for a long time. And so again, we don't yet know where we're going to release this or what we're going to do with this, but I'm really glad we had this conversation. For one, I've just enjoyed it. But also, I think I love your brain so much, and especially like walking through the DSM changes, that was amazing. And just being able to contextualize this conversation with you. I've really enjoyed this.
Me too. 100% always. Let's do this again.
Hey, it's Dr. Neff here. This season, we are clearly talking about autistic burnout, a topic that NeuroDivergent Insights has covered extensively. So if you would like more resources to supplement your learning, we've put together a page where we've curated all of our autistic burnout resources, free and paid resources. We have lots of articles on autistic burnout. We have an upcoming free email course that's going to be released soon. We have workbooks on autistic burnout. So if you'd like to check out our resources, again, both free and paid, you can go to neurodivergentinsights.com/burnout-resources. It's linked below and in the show notes. I hope you don't need these resources, but if you do, they are there for you.